This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. What is the most important quality of a really great writer? What is that one thing she needs to have?
Ta-Nehisi Coates has an answer, and he discovered it in an unlikely place, at one of the world's most renowned science and engineering schools, MIT.
Coates is a critically acclaimed senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Time magazine named his blog one of the best of 2011. This year, he won a National Magazine Award for his article, Fear of a Black President.
In short, Ta-Nehisi Coates knows how to write. But last year, when MIT invited him to teach a writing course at the university, this is how Coates first reacted.
I reacted with quite a bit of shock, if only not because MIT is a science and tech school and an engineering school, but because I didn't even graduate from college. So the notion that I would teach kids anywhere, much less at a university like MIT, sort of boggled the mind.
But Coates decided to do it, and he wrote about it in a recent piece for The Atlantic entitled Notes from the First Year, Some Thoughts on Teaching at MIT. We talked with him about it a little earlier this week.
Ta-Nehisi, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Well, there's a lot going on in the year that you had in Cambridge at MIT, and one of the first things that caught my eye in your piece was when you said that you think that the arts and humanities should not be easy, that classes in those fields should reflect the great difficulty of the actual profession of artist or critic. And that's what you tried to give to your MIT students. So take me into your classroom. How did you try to make the humanities tough for them?
I've been writing professionally for, 16, 17 years now, and it's always been hard. It was hard from the beginning. So the notion that writing was hard was pretty clear to me. And I felt like all I had to do was duplicate in the classroom what I experienced in my best jobs, in my most challenging jobs in writing.
So how do you do that in a classroom?
The first thing you do is you make people write. that seems obvious, but you make people write. I mean, there's great talk about, can you actually teach writing? And you can't teach it in a traditional way. You can't lecture somebody into, a good writing. But what you can do is make them practice over and over. Over and over and over again. The comparison I often used in my classroom was, it was like someone trying to become a great jump shooter. Someone trying to become a great jump shooter may have to take 1,000 jump shots every day. And slowly you get better and you get better. I think of writing as an act of physical courage. You look at a blank screen and you are absolutely terrified, or you put something down and it comes out way, way worse than what, you had, the music you had in your head. My job was to get these folks to challenge that as much as possible.
So in that sentence from your piece that I read, do I get the sense that you feel that humanities is often taught in a way that makes it too easy?
I probably don't have enough experience to make that kind of broad declaration.
Okay.
There are probably people who have been in the academy longer that can speak to that. I will say this. There was certainly a sense among some of my students that the humanities were easier. The notion is that, a math problem can be quantified in a way that writing cannot.
You don't think that's true, though, because you've said in the piece that you think writing is more like math than people might suspect.
I do think writing is more like, I think it's more like engineering, because so much of it is about building something. And I can tell you why, something that you've built is effective or why it's not effective. And it became immediately clear to the students that you could do that. The other part that we did, of course, is we read a ton. The class was about essay, and we read a ton of essays. And you may think, if you're not in the field, that you read an essay that you just like something, that tastes differ, that it's kind of this abstract magic going on that strikes some people and doesn't strike other people. But when you get down to it, when you get 10 folks in a room and they start looking at something and the majority of them like it, and then you ask them why, you can get to tangible reasons about why one thing works and something else doesn't work.
You write that, quote, "I found, for instance, that teaching kids how to write compelling sentences is a lost art." So what did you experience in the classroom that made you discover that?
You start, grading papers and you begin to see a pattern. And the pattern is, to be blunt, weak, apologetic, backtracking sentences that begin with phrases like, "Now to be sure," or before you condemn me, let me say, And one of the things I was really trying to teach is that great essay writing has to be aggressive. And that doesn't mean obnoxious, but it has to be confident. It has to be aggressive. One of the things I used to tell my students was, you should think of yourself as though you are holding the reader's hand and, you guys are taking a tour together. The reader does not want to be on a tour with somebody somebody who is mixed up about where they are going.
So Ta-Nehisi, the thing that really got me in your piece about your year of teaching writing at MIT is you use a particular word about writing and about your students that seems to sort of encapsulate your attitude about what it means to be a writer. And that word is tough. So what does toughness have to do with being a great writer?
Oh, everything in the world. I mean, once you put the words on the page, they rarely sound like the genius you were convinced, you know, they were in your head. It's proving that that, you know, small idea or small idea that you thought was grand when you were out with your friends socializing, is it a real idea? And that's hard. My argument around writing is not so much that people lack the talent to write, that the sheer toughness of it, it just beats you up. It really, really does.
On the comment thread underneath your article on The Atlantic's website, one of your readers, Dr. J, wrote, "I cannot stress enough how valuable a role failure plays in education." Yeah, he says, "I speak of failure," or she, I guess, I can't tell from the Dr. J name, but "I speak of failure of the sort that isn't stigmatized by the teacher, but is just seen as normal and something you just go and fix. This is an enormous emotional shift. It isn't normal for most of the people I run across." But that's a difference that you noted in your MIT students. You've noted that they themselves sort of came to the table with an unusual amount of toughness.
Oh, yeah, they knew all about failure, man. I mean, they beat those kids up so hard at MIT that they came prepared to write, even if they didn't know it. I don't know if they expected to experience, you know, the kind of personal failure that you do when you're trying to write in a writing class. But the notion of trying to do something and it not working, or trying to do something and not being particularly the best at it, it didn't look like it was foreign to them at all.
You know, I love this because, you know, in the process of the long process of scientific or engineering discovery, you know, you toil in the lab, you toil at the computer, you toil at the blackboard. It might take months, it might take years, it might take an entire lifetime. So I get it how the students at a school like MIT sort of come to the table with that, and how it's the very same type of toil when you're writing. But we got to say that you know, MIT is one of those rarefied environments where you kind of get the best of the best in terms of the students who you get to teach. So I'm wondering what you drew out from your year there with those students that you think could apply in classrooms across the country, you know, regardless of whether or not these are students at an elite school.
Here's what I drew out. I was not and am not the best of the best. I am a kid who was tossed out of high school twice. So we were coming from two totally different places. But the idea of toughness, the idea that you should actually have to confront failure, you know, the idea that, you know, life is not going to be celebrating the fact that we're all winners, that you're going to get punched in the face out in the real world. I think that's a real, real lesson. Perseverance. We live in a time right now where there's kind of an obsession with intelligence, with, you know, who's smart and who's not, with ideas, with being counterintuitive. But one of the things I found is that once I went to writing, it really didn't much matter what I had done in the classroom. Nobody cared what happened before I got there. The question was, could you take a punch or not? You know, could you sit down before, you know, a computer and churn out something that was bad, and then go over it again and churn out something that was mediocre, and then go over it again and churn out something that was halfway respectable? If you had done that, you had done your job. Perseverance, at the end of the day, is the value that I'm really, really trying to inculcate. And I think that's true whether you're at MIT or, you know, whether you were, as I was, a college dropout.
Yeah, such an important lesson. Well, Ta-Nehisi Coates is a senior editor for The Atlantic magazine. He wrote a piece in The Atlantic entitled "Notes from the First Year, Some Thoughts on Teaching at MIT." There's a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Ta-Nehisi, such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And And finally, President Barack Obama spoke in Berlin today. He stood at the Brandenburg Gate, a key part of the infamous wall that once divided East and West Berlin.
The president renewed his push for the U.S. and Russia to reduce their nuclear stockpiles. He also said the world must confront the threat of climate change.
Mr. Obama's address comes just a few days before the 50th anniversary of another speech by an American president in Berlin. On June 26, 1963, John F. Kennedy delivered his now famous address denouncing communism at the height of the Cold War.
Today, Obama drew a rhetorical arc back to Kennedy.
And if we lift our eyes as President Kennedy called us to do, then we'll recognize that our work is not yet done. For we are not only citizens of America or Germany, we are also citizens of the world. And our fates and fortunes are linked like never before.
So we thought we'd end today's show with an excerpt from President Kennedy's 1963 speech in Berlin.
So let me ask you as I close to lift your eyes beyond the dangers of today to the hopes of tomorrow, beyond the freedom merely of this city of Berlin or your country of Germany, to the advance of freedom everywhere, beyond the wall, to the day of peace with justice, beyond yourselves and ourselves, to all mankind. Freedom is indivisible. And when one man is enslaved, all are not free. When all are free, then we look forward to that day when this city will be joined as one, and this country, and this great continent of Europe, in a peaceful and hopeful globe. When that day finally comes, as it will, the people of West Berlin can take sober satisfaction in the fact that they were in the front lines for almost two decades. All three men, wherever they may live, are citizens of Berlin. And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
President John F. Kennedy speaking in Berlin, June 26th, 1963. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.